Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles podcast with Dave hosting today, and I'm back with another interview. And today I'm very excited to speak with Kit O'Toole, who's the author of Songs We Were Singing, Guided Tours Through the Beatles' Lesser Known Tracks, and Michael Jackson FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the King of Pop. So I'd like to welcome Kit to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's an absolute honor to be here.
Well, terrific. We're looking forward to getting into some of these lesser known tracks and hear about your background and how you view writing about the Beatles and some of your events that you're doing these days. Actually, we are both in the same upcoming collection of essays, which is the book called New Critical Perspectives on the Beatles, Things We Said Today, that will be published, is it April 1st, I think?
I think so, or thereabouts, yeah.
Okay, and I have an essay on George Harrison and his use of American popular song, and Kit's essay is called She Said, How Women Have Transformed from Fans to Authors in Beatles History. And so I thought we might start by talking about that, since that's your most recent kind of scholarly piece, I guess. So what's that essay about, and just tell us a little bit about it.
Well, you know, the origins of this started by personal experience. You know, some years ago when I was at the Fest for Beatles Fans, I had spent the day, you know, as many of us do, attending the panels and listening to speakers. And it occurred to me that I hadn't seen one woman on those panels. And I thought, what is that about? Because at that point, I had been and still am a contributing editor for Beatle Fan Magazine, and I'm, to my knowledge, I think I'm the only woman on there now that's a regular contributor.
Wow, that's
Isn't that? And I just thought that's fascinating. You know, why in the world is that? And I found out as I was talking to different people, particularly older fans, and I said, female fans, I should say, and I said, why is this? And they said, well, there's this perception with some women that all we do is sit around and talk about how cute Paul is.
Ah.
and
that's all you see in the videos, too. It's the screaming girls. That must be all that they do, right? Yeah.
Precisely. And what do we do when we see those videos and we see the screaming hysterical girls? We laugh.
Yes.
You know, we tend to do that. So that got me thinking, you know, and I just thought, you know, first of all, you know, should we be laughing at that? You know, because the fact of the matter is, those girls were crucial in the Beatles becoming who they were. They bought those records, you know. And back in Liverpool, in fact, I don't have you seen the documentary Good Old Frida?
Yeah, it's terrific. Frida,
yeah, wonderful documentary. Frida and other women, young women in Liverpool, started fan clubs. They, you know, when the Beatles were just starting, you know, when they were playing the Cavern sessions and they were building buzz, they would buy the records. They would call radio stations and request the records. So those women, if it weren't for those women, those teenage girls, I don't know if we'd be talking about them today as we are. So as I started digging into this, I then learned, partially through a wonderful blog that I don't know if you follow, called Meet the Beatles for Real.
No, I don't know that one.
Oh, a terrific blog, and it's run by Sarah Schmidt. In fact, she has a book coming out this summer called Happiness of Seeing the Beatles. And she has been doing this sort of this dedicated site to the fan experience. And what she did was, she found all of these newsletters, these fan newsletters that were created after the Beatles broke up, you know, that they were desperate to, you know, continue the fan community. And it was women who actually started some of the earliest fan newsletters that eventually became, you know, kind of evolved into Beatle Fan and publication, Good Day Sunshine and publications like that. And I never knew about this.
No, you know? That seems like a whole area that's not ever discussed at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So all of this kind of snowballed, and you know, I started going into this more and more, and I found that if you go to a Beatle Fest, Fest for Beatles fans, see, I knew I was going to do that, Fest for Beatles fans.
We can't help it.
We can't help it. We're from the Beatle Fest era.
Yep.
if you go to one today, I mean, the last one I went to last year in Chicago, what a difference it is now when you see the Meet the Authors panel that occurs on Friday night, which is all the authors get up on the main ballroom stage and introduce themselves and their books. I'd say it's now 50% women.
That's terrific. Wow.
Which is what a change.
Yeah.
You know, than like 10 years ago. So that's why I decided to do this chapter. And it's based on a presentation that I did at the Penn State Conference, that, of course, you were there as well, back in 2014, about how women have changed, you know, have evolved from those screaming fans into the historians they are today, and how we've become a part of their story, and how we've helped shape their history and how the story is told today.
Well, that definitely look forward to reading that, because that's definitely an area that has needed some inspection, and I'm glad that you're bringing it to light, because I never really thought of it that way before, but I remember back in the quote-unquote Beatlefest days, it was always the same the same sort of speakers, and I don't ever remember a woman up there at all talking, and yet I know they were very involved and
absolutely
did a lot of work. So
absolutely, and yeah. You know, the one thing that really kind of spurred me on to do all this was when I first brought this up to a group of women, and it said, you know, why aren't there any women speakers? Why aren't there any on the panels? And one of them said to me, well, there's just not much you can do about it. And that's something you should never say to me.
No.
that just made me dig my heels in and say, all right, we've got to start making some changes. And so we're getting there. We're
Good.
Getting there.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And you're also making some great changes in the way we look at some of the Beatles songs, because you're bringing, as the subtitle of your book is, Lesser Known Tracks. I'm kind of curious about how you came to, with a group like the Beatles being so popular, one may not think of there being many lesser known tracks, but obviously you have a whole book of columns that show this. How do you define what a lesser known track is?
Yeah, I've gotten this question quite a bit because, yeah, as you said, you know, particularly hardcore fans, you know, like us,
yeah,
will say there are no lesser known tracks. Well, I found I started writing a column, and that's where this book comes from. I started writing a column for, and still do, for the site Something Else Reviews, and it's called Deep Beatles. And I decided to look at, because this site is read not only by hardcore Beatle fans, but by general fans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I thought, what about looking at, I mean, I love Hey Jude, I love Let It Be, I mean, you know, wonderful, wonderful songs.
Yeah, of course.
But I kind of thought, I don't know what else I have to add to that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, of course I can talk about it, but I thought, you know, we've read a lot about
mm-hmm.
that. What about the songs that were B-sides, that were album tracks, that were, and in other cases, you know, the Star Club sessions, the Decca sessions, stuff that the average person will never hear or rarely hear on the radio. You know, they're not on the number one, the one album that,
no,
of course, in 2000 was a huge hit. And then, you know, it's been revised now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people I know really aren't as familiar with these songs. They only know the hits. You know, and so the other reason I wanted to do this was that it's amazing, as I've researched some of these songs, even Paul and John in past interviews have dismissed some of the songs. I mean, John particularly was infamous.
That's one of our the things that we talk about a lot on the podcast whenever we have a series called Under the Microscope. And so,
yes,
so we pick, you know, one song and really just dissect it. And every time you bring up, you look at the Playboy interviews or something, John always has some dismissive comment like, oh, that was a throwaway, or that was Paul's garbage, not mine. Things
exactly.
like that. So you can't always believe what they say. Half the time they don't remember either. Sometimes Paul just can't remember the tune. So
exactly.
You know, it's good to look at it again.
That's the thing. And so what I wanted to do was take a look at these songs that have been, or even the ones like Run for Your Life that have been controversial.
Oh, yeah.
You know, very controversial. And say, what, you know, what are there in these songs that reveal the Beatles are, you know, very rapid artistic development. You know, where do they fit in? You know, songs that prefigure better known songs that they did that were, you know, kind of rough drafts, and we'll be talking about one of those songs, I think, in a little bit. But I just thought these songs deserve a closer look and more attention. And so that's what I mean by the lesser known songs.
Well, it's fascinating because there are some tunes that I think a lot of people would say are good songs that no matter what you think about them. But in some cases, and I found this particularly intriguing, you discuss and even maybe defend a couple of tunes that are notoriously ranked quite low in the fan favorite category. And I'm thinking of ones like "Honey Don't," although you talk about the John Lennon version, not the Ringo version. And then, of course, everybody's favorite, "Mr. Moonlight." And
Oh, Dave, don't get me started on Mr. Moonlight. I
I
can I can give a talk about Mr. Moonlight.
I must encourage you to go read what Kit says about Mr. Moonlight because it did, you know, I think I probably just, you know, drank the Kool-Aid on that song and just believed what everybody, oh, okay, they all dismissed it and John screaming and all this. But after reading what you said, I did go back and listen to it again. And I thought, okay, it's not so bad. And there's some neat things about it. The organ part is kind of quirky and some things about it are worth hearing again. So, do you feel like you're ever trying to defend some of the tunes, or is it more just, like you said, make people listen with a fresh perspective?
Well, I mean, certainly, and again, but I will not go into Mr. Moonlight in detail because you only have an hour. But that was a classic case where I thought that song, you know, that's a song I defend because I thought that was unfairly dismissed. Now, I am certainly not saying that's the best thing they ever recorded. I mean, definitely, and the organ. That was a questionable addition, shall we put it that way? Maybe that was a bad choice. But I would say that John's vocal on that, particularly at the beginning, I mean, that's spine-tingling stuff, I think. I mean, it just showed what a powerful rock singer he was. Of course, he would completely disagree with
Oh,
that. He
yeah.
notoriously hated his voice. But I mean, that song to me is just a perfect example of the power and rawness that he possessed in his voice. Another song, as I mentioned just a minute ago, you know, "Run for Your Life." You know, today we tend to focus on the you know, shall we say, not as enlightened kind of lyrics.
Yeah, a little questionable.
A little questionable, I agree with that. But if you listen to it musically, it's actually a pretty compelling track and you know, surprisingly catchy. But I agree, it's hard to get past those lyrics. But and John, even in later years, disavowed them, you know, and said that was, you know, that was definitely, he was at a certain point in his life, and you know, he wouldn't write those lyrics years later.
No,
But
he said it
yeah.
was a favorite of George's, though. And no matter,
Exactly. And that is the whole point of my book. I thought, okay, it's a favorite of George's. Why? You know, why would George defend that? And so, you know, that's what I tend to do. Now, there are other songs. What I love to do too, and I don't know if you've done this along the way as well, is I will go back and look at songs that and listen again to songs that in the beginning I didn't really care for, and years later I go back and revisit them. Blue Jay Way is a great example of that. That I wrote about. It's not in the book. It's online. One of the columns that I did recently. That is a song that when I first started getting into the Beatles, I just did not respond to that song at all. You
No.
know, I don't know. I don't know if it was just too strange for me at the time. I don't know. So I challenged myself. I thought, okay, I'm going to go back and listen to it again with fresh ears and see if I've changed my mind, you know. And I did. I found that now I appreciate it more, the experimental aspect of it and the sort of surreal lyrics and you know, now I appreciate it more as George continuing to broaden his composing techniques and becoming more and more experimental like John and Paul were, you know. And so I love doing that too. with this column. Now, I don't always, you know, am I going to write about Revolution Number 9 and say that was the best track they ever did? Probably not.
No.
You know, I appreciate it for the, you know, the experimental artistic aspect of it, but it's not something I would go back and listen to over and over again. Let's put it that way. But there are other songs like Blue Jay Way that I do enjoy going back to and reassessing and sort of recasting in the whole Beatles canon. So that's great fun for me.
That's pretty interesting because Chris and I just our I think our most recent episode was ranking George Harrison's 22 group songs, and I think we both put Blue Jay Way at the bottom. So
Yeah,
maybe
isn't it funny? Because
yeah.
I, you know, years ago, I would have done the same thing. Absolutely would have done the same thing. I'm still not a big fan of Long, 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 but, you know, maybe I might, that might be another column.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Maybe that may be a future column. But it's interesting. And that's the other great thing about talking about these songs, because, you know, it's funny when I do these columns and I get responses online. I mean, they range everywhere. The comments range everywhere from, wow, I totally forgotten about that song, or kind of like what you said about Mr. Moonlight, I never thought of it that way. And then you get comments of, how could you possibly devote a column to that song? What were you thinking? You know, I got that. I think it was for For You Blue.
Oh.
That was
Oh.
one of the more controversial columns I
Really?
did. Yeah, which I thought was strange. And another one that more recently, it's not in the book, was Lovely Rita.
That's a great song. What
Which,
oh,
yeah, boy,
yeah.
a couple of people, how could you possibly write it?
Oh.
This was one of the weakest songs. I mean,
No
it's
way.
just fascinating.
Wow. Well,
Just fascinating to me.
I wonder if it can work the other way though. Do you ever look think you know come you decide you're going to pick a song to look at and analyze, and then you realize, oh, this is actually not very good, and it's
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, you know, I ran into that recently, not with the column, but when the Paul McCartney Archive Collection reissued Tug of War and Pipes of Peace. Okay, now Tug of War, I still love.
Oh yeah.
Great album, you know. But Pipes of Peace, that was a sentimental favorite for me because that was the first album, Paul album I ever owned. You know, and it was because, and I'm not saying this for a promotion of my book, but hey, it doesn't hurt. Michael Jackson. That's why I bought it in the beginning. It was because of Say, Say, Say. You
Yeah.
know, that was at the peak of Michael Jackson's career. So I had great affection for that album, and I used to really defend it. You know, and to some of my friends who thought it was one of the weakest albums Paul did. So when I got the opportunity to review the two reissues for something else, I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. And so Tug of War, haven't changed my mind at all. I love that album. I mean, it's I just have always just connected with it. Pipes of Peace, wow, that was interesting to listen to again. There are still parts of it I like. I think So Bad is a beautiful song. I love the harmony on that.
Yeah.
You know, there are a few gems on there. Say, Say, Say is great pop. You know, I still think it's very memorable, very catchy. But there's some others on there.
Some filler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Filler. That as I listen to them now, I think, you know, like Average Person,
Oh
and yeah,
yeah.
some of it. I and The Other Me, I mean, that there's some
Yeah.
lyrics in there, acted like a dustbin
That's a
lid.
t
I
Ugh.
yeah. Although I did find out recently that is a Liverpudlian expression. Did not
Okay.
know that.
So a little
So
regionalism.
a little regionalism, so I guess we can cut a little slack there. But
Okay.
other than that, so it's just fascinating how your opinion can change. So that was a case where I had to write about it and say, well, it has some moments on there, but it's not as strong. I think for me, it was more, as I said, it was sentimental. You know, I had such a sentimental attachment that it was I had to force myself to listen to it, you know, putting all that sentimental stuff aside, and
Sure.
I had a different opinion of it after that.
Well, you mentioned sentimentalism, and so going back to your first encounters with the Beatles, you and I share some similarity because in my fourth grade class at Sunset Ridge School, it was during the 20th anniversary of the Beatles coming to America. And I remember our general music class, I think her name was Miss Di Pietro or something. We sang two Beatles songs to commemorate the occasion. So each class sang a couple of Beatles songs, and I vaguely remember Penny Lane being one of them. But I remember at that point, something just caught me, and it was like, whoa, I got to know more about this. And I remember going out and buying the record of the 20 greatest hits. And that, here we are today. So, tell us how you became a Beatle fan, and do you have any musical background yourself?
Well, the musical background I have, I did take some guitar lessons at one point, but it's really more growing up. My dad, he's not a professional musician, but he played and still plays guitar, bass, drums, and saxophone.
Great.
Yeah, and he played at our church. He led the guitar mass at our church. So it, I grew up listening. I mean, if I wasn't listening well, and I'll show my age here, 8 tracks. Dad had his 8-track player. I remember that quite well. If he wasn't playing 8 tracks, he was playing his own music. So I grew up with it, and I grew up with jazz, rock, soul, you name it. You know, he was into everything and still is. So that was really my background. I just started getting more and more interested in it. I just had been immersed in it as a kid. And I had heard Dad play some Beatles stuff. He loved Michelle in particular. I remember he played Michelle quite a bit. Played Let It Be in church and that sort of thing. But being a kid, I thought, oh, come on, that's old music. And it wasn't until 8th grade, in Mr. Tantillo's class at the Hinsdale Junior High in Illinois, I remember it vividly. On Fridays, he let us bring in our own music. Now, looking back, I think it was maybe a night. I mean, I love Mr. Tantillo, but I think it may have also been a bit of a day off for him because
Sure,
he
no
let us
prep.
bring in. That's nothing wrong with that.
No.
So, so he let us bring in cassettes. Of course, it was cassettes by that point. This was 1985. And somebody brought in this one day the 20 Greatest Hits album. And I wasn't paying much attention at the time. I remember talking with a friend. At this point, I was probably steeped in, Duran Duran, Wham. I mean,
Oh,
80s pop. And 8 Days a Week came on. And for some reason, that grabbed me. My ears just perked up. I think it was the rhythm. I think it was the interesting chord changes. I mean, I don't know if that's what I was consciously thinking at the time, but I think it just, I just thought this sounded like nothing else I'd heard, And after that, I thought I've got to check this group out. And so I started buying, of course, all the cassettes. This would have been the American albums,
Yes.
no British album.
Pre-1987, yeah.
Exactly. None of
Yep.
that was available yet. And I just became fascinated. I remember watching the Complete Beatles documentary,
That was actually
which I
really
still,
great. Yeah.
wasn't it? I still think it's a great documentary.
Yeah.
It was good overview.
Yeah, was it ever released on DVD? I still had the VHS of it.
Yeah, I don't think it was. And it's a shame because I think one of the best moments in that, because of course Malcolm McDowell was the narrator, and my the one part I remember so vividly was when he was talking about Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh, I remember that.
Remember this?
Yeah.
And he said, the plot was that they'd get all these different characters on a bus, from all different walks of life, and film what happened. Nothing did.
Unfortunately, nothing did or something.
I mean, that just kind of summed up the movie for me.
Yes,
I
it
mean, I
did.
just it's just, it was great. So, I mean, yeah, I still think it's a great documentary. So I watched that, and then as the years went on, I just, and I was writing, by college, I was writing for a music publication called Showcase Chicago. I was, getting more involved in writing about music, but it was really just a hobby. And then in the mid 90s, I started writing for Beatle Fan Magazine because they were looking for a columnist to write about the brand new invention called the internet.
Yes, I remember.
Where Beatle sites were starting to pop up. And so I, auditioned and ended up getting. I still write that column, and then it kind of snowballed. I went on with, I got a master's in writing and later a doctorate in instructional technology. But I always had I was always writing about music and about the Beatles as a side thing. And then I decided after I finished my doctorate to try pursuing it full time. And that's where I am now.
Because you actually, something I noticed about your columns is that you, not the Beatle fan one, but your the ones in the book, is
Yeah.
that even though you don't have, necessarily a lot of great technical background in music, you write very musically about the songs. And so I think that's important to reach a diverse kind of audience. And I think it shows some of your background. And you speak as a fan, but also with a little bit more depth to it so that there's enough for everybody to read. And so I particularly like that in the you kind of made me freshen my perspective on some of the early period Beatles stuff like the Decca Audition and the Star Club recordings and things like that because you I dismissed and songs like Three Cool Cats and things like that because they're just to me kind of jokey songs that are simple musically and just don't seem to have a lot to them but how do you see songs from that early period relating to kind of the Beatles' progress? And then how do you view writing about something like Three Cool Cats or a song like that, that again would be seen as kind of dismissive and simple, but yet you must view it as kind of fitting into the Beatles' story somehow?
Exactly. Well, and first of all, thank you for what you said about my writing, because that is exactly what I like to do. I bring in the fans' perspective, but I try to I love to take apart songs and sort of figure out how they work,
Yeah.
and so, thank you very much for that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yep. And so yeah, so going to the so the Decca auditions. I just think that is so fascinating because on the one hand, I totally agree. You listen to it at first and you think, oh, this is, this can't compare
No.
to what they became, And I agree, but I think it's important to listen to it to determine how they grew. I think that is so, it is so important. For example, like with Three Cool Cats, to me, first of all, it gives us a kind of a snapshot of what they were doing in Hamburg, the kind of songs they were playing, because unfortunately we don't have, we don't have much in the way of those recordings. And the recordings we have are,
A
little
lot of tape
rough.
hiss, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so this is as close as we're going to get, let's face it. But the other thing I thought, going back and listening to those Decca sessions and tracks like Three Cool Cats, George really had a, kind of emerged, I think, as an early talent in the group even then,
He had a
because
lot more, yeah, a lot more visibility than he would later. He sang a lot on those tracks.
exactly, and he
Yeah.
was good.
And he was good.
He was good, and I think that tends to get lost because people tend to say George really didn't start emerging as a singer and all until a couple of years into the group. When you listen to the Decca sessions, that's not true.
No, not at all. He was better than Paul, especially a Love of the Loved. I think that Paul's really
And
rough.
I as I talk about it in the book that Paul does. I mean, he sounds very nervous
Yes.
on a lot of the tracks and has some weird, kind of enunciates strangely on such a,
Yes.
yep, and or tries to affect what I call the Paul Ramone voice, where he's trying to sound like others, and he hasn't developed his own style quite yet.
Right.
And by the way, I think that's another good reason to listen to these tracks, because we tend to remember the Beatles as what they became and these incredibly professional people. But it's fascinating to listen to them in these recordings as they were trying to find who they were. They were and there were early signs of it in these recordings, like Three Cool Cats. The charisma was there.
Oh
Yes,
yeah.
it was kind of, I mean, yes, it was a bit on the corny side, But you could imagine them performing this song in front of an audience and getting the audience into it, and interacting. And I just think the charisma that George Martin later talked about, that drew him to the group when they auditioned for him. The charisma's there in tracks like that, but it has yet to be fully developed. And that's why I think that, yes, the Decca audition tapes are not them at their best, but I think historically it's a very important document.
I would definitely agree. And when I teach a Beatles class, one of the exercises we do is I play I think there are five tracks on the anthology one from the Decca sessions, and I have my students pretend that they're Brian Epstein or George Martin or someone deciding, well, should we sign these guys or not here? And we always, I have them write comments about each song. I'll say, okay, well, here's "Hello, Little Girl." This is the next one. Let's write about it. And then at the end, I take a tally. I say, well, how many of you would sign this group? And it's almost always split half and half. So how would you feel if I just played you those tunes? Would you take the chance? Do you think if you were George Martin back then, or I guess Decca didn't take them, so would you have agreed with Decca?
This is so funny that you bring it up. First of all, can I sit in on your class?
Yeah,
Because that sounds
please.
like a lot of fun.
We'd
I
love
would
to have
love
you.
to. I
Come to
would
Kansas City.
love that. I've got to do that someday. I'd love it. The author Jude Kessler, Jude Sutherland Kessler, who's written, she's writing a series of books about John Lennon's life and called the John Lennon series. And she hosts a podcast, or did. She's now going to she's sort of retooling it and is going to come out with a new one. But it used to be called the John Lennon Hour, and we do this series periodically. In fact, we're going to be doing one at the upcoming New York Fest for Beatles fans. And it's a show we do together called Kit and Caboodle.
Perfect. Great title.
Isn't that great? Yep, people remember it. And we examine different topics, kind of like what you do on your podcast. And we did this. We did a show where we looked at the Decca sessions, and then we had a big discussion, and people called in. And that was the question: would you hire this group? And it was the same thing. It was split 50-50.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. I mean, there were people who argued passionately that, hey, there were these glimmers of talent here, and you bet I would have hired them. And others that said, nah, I would say this doesn't quite cut it yet. As far as I go, I mean, I'm so torn because I think if I listened to this cold, I don't know if I would have hired them because. They're the and again, I think there were and I talk about this a bit in the book, and we've read about it from various sources. The series of events that led up to the recording and
Oh,
the
right.
condition they were in. I mean, it was almost a comedy of
I
errors,
know it's ridiculous with the not having amps and all this.
Oh, I'm so it was in the worst
Yeah,
circumstances.
cold studio and everything.
Exactly. I think the engineer was hungover. I mean, it was
New
just.
Year's, yeah.
It was just, as I said, it was an absolute comedy of, the Beatles got lost in a snowstorm. I mean, it just went on and on, So, when you know the whole story, you then think, okay, I think it is understandable that perhaps they were not at their best. I think part of it, and this is what seemed to be the consensus in the end after we did this show, part of the problem was Ringo was really the missing piece.
His Pete
And
is so weak on those tracks.
exactly. And I mean, I've got to say, I've met Pete, I bet, and nice guy. I don't, I always say this, I don't want to beat up on him.
No.
But he just didn't have the power, that Ringo had and has. Or the imagination. Ringo was such a versatile drummer, and I talk about that a bit in the book. And was able to adapt to so many different kind of styles and fit the mood of the song. I don't think Pete had that ability.
No, definitely
No,
not.
he didn't. And so that was another big problem. The energy, I think Ringo really with his kind of that really just that hard drumming that he could do, I think that upped the energy of the songs, and that just isn't there in the Decca recordings. I mean, it just isn't.
No, it isn't. But it is there in later tracks. And so we started off, well, let's take a little music break here. We started off by listening to I Want to Tell You, because I asked Kit to pick three tracks that she discusses in her book that are particularly meaningful or that you feel strongly about. And so we started off with I Want to Tell You. So I wanted to hear why you picked that, and then we'll go into your next track.
Well, I would say I think it's I talked just a few minutes ago about George gradually becoming, more experimental in his writing, and I think this was an early, somewhat early example of that. And one of the reasons is that piano. That to me is the killer part
Da
of
da 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 da
Yeah,
da
exactly. And
da.
that discordant sound.
Yes.
It has that sort of it almost sounds like a sort of a galloping effect, which fits in with the lyrics, with George singing, having too much to say, all hung up and I don't know why. I mean, he seems to be sort of tripping over his words, I mean, say, I mean, just with the title alone, I want to tell you, and having too much to say, and that piano. And it's such an unusual touch.
It
I mean,
is. It is.
it really is, for particularly, for that time. I just thought that is such an example of the Beatles' ingenuity in adding little things like that enhance the mood of the song, that accent the lyrics, and certain words of the lyrics. And I mean, the whole song is great. The
Oh,
guitar is
yeah.
fantastic, and at that beginning guitar that fades in. But that piano to me was the clincher. That I just think that's such a special track.
And it kind of gets swallowed up a little bit on Revolver, and right with what comes before and after it. So you,
Oh, absolutely. I
yeah.
mean, I mean, it's such a stellar album from beginning to finish. But exactly, people tend to talk about Tomorrow Never Knows, which I love,
Of course,
and
yeah.
then and Paul's, Here, There, and Everywhere. And I mean, and yeah, this song tends to get buried, as you said, but I think it's just as revolutionary in many ways as some of the other tracks are.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And the next song we're going to play is a song that we discussed under the microscope not too long ago. And it's a great tune from A Hard Day's Night. So we'll listen to it. It's I'll Be Back. And then we'll hear what Kit has to say about that.
You know, if you break my heart, I'll go. But I'll be back again. 'Cause I told you once before goodbye, but I came back again. I love you so, oh, I'm the one who wants you. Yes, I'm the one who wants you. Oh, oh. Could find better things to do than to break my heart again. This time I will try to show that I'm not trying to pretend.
I hate to stop it there, but it is great to hear that. And I want to ask you about I'll Be Back, but in context of a fascinating part of your book is you spend a lot of time talking about the 2009 remastered Beatles CDs that came out, and that was from the stereo box set. How do you view those? How do you think that release changed our Beatles listening experience? And almost 7 years later, how do you think those recordings hold up? And you can start with I'll Be Back, or just go right to the recordings, or however you want to answer it.
Well, sure. Well, first of all, I'll Be Back, I think is just another example not only of how the Beatles were developing artistically, because those are some very sophisticated harmonies.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
They were gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And the little bit of, there's a little Latin flavor in there. I mean, it just showed that they were I mean, even, in 1964, and it's still at the height of the, quotes, mop top era,
right,
that they were broadening their sound. And, as I was listening to you play that, I was just thinking about years ago when I was at a fest for Beatles fans. see, I can do it. Yeah. And I was watching... they had one of the, I think it was one of the NME like year-end poll concerts, and the Beatles, I mean, my gosh, it probably got repetitive after a while to have those poll concerts because the Beatles won every single
year.
Exactly. But, watching one of those concerts, it was so fascinating because you could see why. Not just because, of course, this was the height of Beatlemania, in 64, but when you heard the Beatles perform and then you'd hear the other groups, of that time, I mean, some of them were great. I love Jerry and the Pacemakers. I mean, I think they were terrific, but the Beatles were always just a couple of steps or more above, they had, I mean, nobody else sounded like them.
No.
Nobody. They were doing things, as I said, interesting, unusual chord changes that no other groups really, or few anyway, were attempting. And this I'll Be Back, to me, is just a perfect example of that. I mean, when you listen to something like that and then you listen to other British Invasion groups, their peers, they just weren't doing that.
Yeah.
And so that, it just, as I said, when you were playing that song, it just made me flash back to watching one of those readers' poll concerts that I just thought, wow, it just reminds me of how, even back then when I was watching it, I thought, wow, the Beatles just really sounded like no one else.
Yeah.
At the time, that's for sure. Then going back to the other part of your question. So yeah, the 2009 remasters, I did a series of columns, which, as you mentioned, are in the book, where I took a close look, and this was for another site I was writing for at the time named Blog Critics. And I really tried to go into, what is remastering, and I have to tell you, I'm very proud of this series, and I had to do a lot of research.
It's very clear. It's one of the most clear explanations of what can be very muddy to figure out with all the terminology. You hear people just drop the terms remixed and remaster all the time, but then they're not the same thing, and it's good that you actually took the time to explain that.
Well, thank you, and that means a lot coming from you. Absolutely. I mean, because as I said, I'm not formally trained, and so I really had to go and because that's exactly what I wanted to look at. What people, as you said, throw around those terms all the time, and I thought, what do they mean exactly?
Yeah.
And so that's something I tried to talk about. I think that the remasters, and they were controversial at the time. I mean, they still are. If you get a bunch of really hardcore fans in a room and have them listen, I remember we got letters to Beatle Fan Magazine where people would say they reversed the bass channels.
Oh,
and
no.
Blah, blah, blah.
Conspiracy theories here.
Exactly. And I just thought, oh, no. I mean, that's just not,
No.
But, I mean, I will say I appreciated them because, I mean, let's face it, the 1987 CDs, I mean, were so muddled.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they were like they were remastered or remixed in a tin can, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's what they sound like now. And it took too long for this to happen. So what I think, and I should say, to me, what really made me excited about these remasters was when I saw the Cirque du Soleil show Love.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To me, that soundtrack gave us a real preview and a taste of what these songs could sound like.
And remember the same thing with the Yellow Submarine song track.
Absolutely.
It was such a different experience. Wow, I never heard that guitar line back there. I never heard that there was a tambourine there.
Well, that's exactly what I think the remasters brought and why I appreciate them so much, because you do hear these little things and that are clarified and that you've never noticed before. I mean, actually going back to Love, I'll never forget watching that show. And, in that theater, they said like 6,000 speakers.
Wow.
Something. Wow. Yeah. And there are speakers in the seats.
Oh my god! Surrounded.
I mean, I'm not embarrassed to say I was nerding out at that show. I mean, if are a hardcore Beatles fan, you've got to see this show. And I'll never forget sitting there, and I hear this, like, somebody is singing in my ear. And I thought, gosh, you know, I was sort of glaring at the man sitting next to me, thinking, oh, great, because he had been sort of air drumming at various points during the show, so it was kind of annoying me to begin with. And I thought, oh, great, he's singing along. And so I turned to give him a, you know, death glare.
Yeah.
he wasn't singing. And I realized, oh my gosh, and I think it was a Paul vocal I had never heard before.
Wow.
And it sounded like he was singing right in my ear, you know. And that's when I thought, okay, we're not hearing parts of the songs that we could be hearing with new technology. So when the 2009 remasters came out, for all their possible flaws, you know, and as I said, I'm sure we could go on debating about it, but I think they really, to me, they enhanced my appreciation of the songs, and they enabled me to do columns like Deep Beatles, where I was able to pull out these details that I had never heard before, you know, a certain guitar lick or a certain, you know, a little, you know, a hi-hat or something that I had never noticed before. And so for all their flaws, and I'm sure, you know, you could point out many, but I think on the whole, though, they were such an improvement, over the old ones.
Yeah, it really was almost like hearing them again for the first time. And it's a cliche, but it really is true in that case. And, but a lot of it, you talked about how the Beatles are just doing things and sounded like no one else. And a huge reason for that was George Martin, who of course just recently passed away. And so I wanted to ask you a couple Beatle questions left, and then we'll get into your other subject here. What are some of your favorite George Martin moments? And I want to go beyond the kind of the classic ones like "Oh Yesterday" or, you know, things like that. But do you have any favorite George Martin moments? Maybe in your re-listening to "Pipes of Peace," anything stand out? Or just kidding. I won't bait you there. But.
Oh
yeah,
you play dirty.
I know. You can ignore that, but at least other favorite George Martin moments.
You know, I think for me, I wrote the last Deep Beatles column I wrote was dedicated to him, of course, and I talked about some of my favorite moments in Beatles songs. And here's what I can say. This is a bit more of a general observation, but this was sort of the thrust of my article, that I said, here is somebody who, when you saw him, he looked and sounded like the perfect, proper English gentleman, you know, and yet this maverick streak he had was just phenomenal. And he would go along with, you know, and enable and really able to execute the Beatles' vision. Like he talked about, and I knew this, but it was interesting to reread it again, how he said Paul was a bit, his musical vocabulary was a bit clearer. I mean, he could say to George, I want this kind of sound. I want, you know, I want the violin to be here, you know. I mean, and particularly along as the years went on, he got better and better at that. John was much more, I mean, I love George. I found a quote from George Martin who said, you know, years ago, John would say to him, I need this to sound more orange.
That sounds like a Lennon-ism.
Doesn't it? I believe it. Yeah. I believe it. You know, and like, look at Tomorrow Never Knows. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're talking about, which is one of my all-time favorite Beatle tracks, by the way. I love that. And one of the things, you know, John would talk to him, you know, I want to sound like the Dalai Lama on the mountaintop. And, you know, and then I want the sound of 4,000 monks, you know, chanting. Now, most producers, I think, would say, exactly. But, you know, I mean, maybe George didn't do exactly that, but he got darn close.
Yes,
he did. And I think he was able to create these sounds. And like, well, what about, you know, being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, when John said to him, I want to smell the sawdust,
mm-hmm.
you know, and George Martin knew what he meant. You know, I mean, I just think that's amazing. And, you know, and was able, and I mean, I know this has been written about quite a bit, but I still think it's amazing how he, you know, got the recording of the Calliope and then cut up the pieces and all that. I mean, who else would have thought of that
at
that time? I mean, I just think that's phenomenal. And also, what other producer would have, you know, brought in a new group? I mean, you know, here are the Beatles coming in when he first, you know, after they auditioned and he first agreed to start recording them. And at the time, producers would say to groups, this is what you're going to record.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, fine, you know. Instead, so George presents them with a surefire hit. You know, how do you do it?
How do you do it?
Exactly. Which was, of course, it did become a hit. And it is a great pop song.
Mm-hmm.
And here is this group, brand new group, saying, nah, I don't think so. You know, we've written better. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine another producer at that time saying, well, okay, you know, go ahead. We're going to record. Let's do a version of How Do You Do It. But okay, let's hear what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of other producers who ever would have agreed to that.
No, yeah. It was just the perfect fit for
them. It really was. And so I think George Martin, his real strength, he was a risk taker. You know, and he was just, you wouldn't think that, you know, at first. I mean, when you see the pictures of him working with the Beatles, particularly in their early years, and John, you know, George Martin's in his tie and he looks very formal and looks, you know, a bit older than the Beatles. And yet, you know, he had such an adventurous side to him and would go along with these things. I can't imagine what the Beatles would have sounded like without him.
No,
I really don't.
No, yeah. Not at all.
Mm-mm.
So, and even on Pipes of Peace, for example, as we segue to one final Beatle question here, most of your book deals with the group songs, of course, and mm-hmm. But you do devote some space to solo albums and some lists about lesser known Lennon tunes and mm-hmm. McCartney tunes. So how would you assess each Beatle solo career kind of in a snapshot? And then whose music do you find most compelling as a solo artist?
Ooh, yeah. Boy, that is a tough question because. You know, like one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, George's solo albums. And of course, I mean, All Things Must Pass, a masterpiece, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, what more is there to say? It's just amazing. But he did some, and I mean, yes, his output in the 70s could be erratic, you know, in terms of quality.
Extra texture. Yeah.
Yes, extra texture and, you know, some of the Dark Horse mm-hmm. that had its moments, but, you know. But I think 33 and a Third was excellent.
Me too.
Love that album, you know. And I don't think it gets the attention it deserves. You know, I think, I mean, the material in it, it just covered everything from, you know, from soul with Pure Smokey mm-hmm. To some beautiful love songs to, you know, some very introspective songs like See Yourself. I mean, he really covered the gamut on
yeah.
that. I just, you know, and I just thought that was a superb album. And of course, Cloud Nine was, I mean, that's a little bit of a sentimental one for me too. That came out when I was in high school. I loved it. And it's still a great album. So, I mean, his work could be a bit erratic. It was still, I mean, when he was at his best, you know, I mean, he truly could, you know, and he was a little more, you know, he would embrace world music a lot more than the others did and that sort of thing. Paul obviously was brilliant at sort of melding, you know, rock and pop. Again, yes, some erratic, you know, albums. Now, I do talk about in the book, Press to Play,
we're going to be doing because it's the 30th anniversary of that, I think, this year.
Oh my goodness, I think you're right.
Yeah, wow. So we're going to talk about that because Chris, I don't think he said he's, I don't think he's ever listened to it, but which is interesting. You mentioned that your first McCartney album was Pipes of Peace, and mm-hmm. mine was Press to Play on cassette, so I definitely remember and have that sentimental.
I have it on cassette.
Oh yeah.
I still have it.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So I've got that.
Yeah, and I think I'm not saying that's the perfect album.
No.
Yes, it suffers from some 80s overproduction and that sort of thing. But there's some nice. I mean, I think Only Love Remains is one of those.
Oh, beautiful song.
Just a beautiful, beautiful song. So, I mean, there are some great moments on that. And so I think, you know, yes, there's some albums, you know, that weren't quite as strong, Driving Rain. And
yeah, you won't get an argument from me on that one.
Yes, you know, I was going to say Driving Rain.
Driving
and,
Rain. Yeah.
but still, I mean, I think he, you know, he could really tap into, and I say this, I'm not saying this in a derogatory way, into the commercial.
Yes.
Brilliantly. You know, and I mean, he did it without sacrificing integrity, really, I think. John was certainly, you know, I would say much more, you know, confessional and a bit more of a risk taker. Again, didn't always work.
Mm-hmm.
And he could be a bit erratic in his albums, too. But of course, you know, John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band, that was just an incredible album. Imagine, even though he later kind of dismissed it as candy coated, I don't care. I still think that's a wonderful.
It is.
I love that album.
Yeah.
I just thought it, yes, it was more commercial sounding than his previous albums, but
so what? Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, so what? It was still a masterpiece. What mm-hmm. can I say? And Double Fantasy, while it wasn't quite as strong, I think, you know, it still had, of course, some classics on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was interesting. Al Sussman, who writes on BeatleFam with me, and he's long-time Beatles expert.
Yes.
In the late 70s, he did an article. Actually, I think it was 1980. He did an article kind of assessing the Beatles' solo careers and gave them grades. And he gave John an incomplete because, you know, it is so hard to say where he would have gone.
That's true.
You know?
That's true.
You just... Obviously, you can't. So it's so hard to really assess John's career because it does have that kind of unfinished
yes.
quality to it. But, you know, I mean, he was painfully honest, and at times people didn't want to hear that. And it didn't sell all the time, but he did what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And Ringo, now I do talk about Ringo a bit in the book, and I thought that single he came out with in the early 90s, Weight of the World, that was a great song.
That's a great song. And actually,
isn't that a great song?
It is, and that album, actually, I thought was pretty good, too.
Exactly. I mean, these
underrated.
Days you tend to... Yeah, exactly. And these days you tend to hear more about his stuff with Mark Hudson,
which
was good.
Yeah.
You know, great stuff, but I think that's been unfairly overlooked. I think, you know, the Way of the World and that whole album. Of course, the Ringo album is probably the best. I mean, that was the most consistent, you know. So, but he's taken some interesting twists and turns, too. I mean, I think he recognizes that his talents are different, in a way, than the other band members.
Yeah.
You know, let's put it that way. And I think he knows his limitations and he works with them very well. And when I say limitations, I'm not putting him down.
No,
I'm
no,
just
no.
saying that's just the fact. I mean, his voice isn't as strong as the others and that sort of thing. But I think he knows who he is. And he knows the kinds of material that suit him best, and he does that, and so I mean it is interesting how they all kind of went in different directions with their careers, and of course had varieties of successes and that sort of thing. I think part of it though is, you know, I think when Paul and John wrote together, you know. They worked so well together because one of them could bring in a lyric and the other felt free to say, that's crap.
You had the quality control that was kind of missing in the solo period.
That's what was to me the big issue in the solo years. That quality control was gone, you know? And I mean, these days, you know, I mean, Paul, yes, he works with wonderful musicians, but I don't get the sense that they would say to him,
No. Could you imagine saying, Paul, this is a lousy song. You need to give me something better here. Come on. No one's going to say that.
Exactly. I mean, you know, well, I mean, the only producer in recent years that I've heard that did do that was, I think it was Chaos and Creation in the Backyard.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm blanking on the name of the producer now. Oh,
yeah.
My gosh. I can't remember now, but whoever that was, he was the only one that I've heard actually did say to him at times, no, that's not, that's just not strong enough. They haven't worked together after that.
That was Nigel Godrich, I think. Was
Thank
that,
you.
That's
yes.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. And yeah, they haven't worked together.
No,
again after
funny,
that, have they?
Funny that. Yeah. Wow. Well, speaking of people who didn't work together after a certain point, our old friend Michael Jackson was back in the news recently with Sony purchasing the rest of his shares in the Beatles catalog for a cool $750 million. Mm. So your other book is about Michael Jackson, and it's called Michael Jackson FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the King of Pop. So how did you get asked, or how did you decide to write about Michael Jackson?
Well, I actually was asked the author Robert Rodriguez, who's written some, wonderful books, and he actually devised, I think, the whole FAQ concept for Backbeat Books. These FAQ books are actually not biographies. They're really in-depth studies of a person's music. I think they've expanded now into movies and television and different things. And so he had written, as I said, in addition to coming up with the FAQ concept, he had written a couple of Beatles FAQs for them. So he approached me and said, they're really interested in a Michael Jackson FAQ. And I said, as long as I can write about the music, I'm fine with that.
You don't want to touch the life. Oh, no.
No. I mean, it's just, and I have nothing to add. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know. I mean, and it just doesn't interest me.
No.
Whereas I will say, and I talk about this in the introduction to the book, that, when he debuted the Moonwalk on Motown 25 in 1983, I argue that was my generation's equivalent of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, because I remember the next day after that aired, going to, I think I was in sixth grade when that aired,
In
the playground, everybody was trying to figure out how to do it.
Yes.
Everybody saw that. Everybody talked about it, and it was a turning point. And so I was particularly a big fan, when I was much younger. And so I thought I would like to write a book that takes a serious look at his art, and his music, his impact on culture, and how he learned how to become a songwriter, how he learned his craft. And so the book covers from the Jackson 5 through his death, and I talk a bit about some of the projects that came out after his death as well. And I hope I've captured that aspect to say, forget the other stuff. Let's look right now at what's important, which is his legacy.
And that's great to do, because despite all the, the paparazzi and all the scandal, all the stuff around his life, fundamentally Michael Jackson had an amazing voice and such an artist that, the music will carry him through even if all the rest of it's just a big mess.
Exactly. Because that's the thing. I mean, I've said to people, when I've talked about this, why do we still hear his music on the radio?
Yeah.
Why, when we go to wedding receptions, do we still hear Billie Jean? And when Thriller comes on, everybody breaks into the dance, because that's the impact he had on culture. And Jackson, Jackson 5 too, was, people don't really think of it now, but it was they were kind of a groundbreaking act.
Because,
they were really among the earliest, African Americans artists to really have a big crossover success like that. I mean, there really weren't African American teen idols back when they came out in 1969. I mean, Frankie Lyman was only other one.
Right.
So they were among the first African Americans to have their own cartoon series, things like that. So so they were, I was fascinated as I was researching this, because some of this I'd never thought of, so absolutely. And, and I do talk about the collaborations that he and Paul did, of course.
I was going to ask, I can't wait to see what you say about The Girl Is Mine.
Yeah, it was, I talk about the making of it, and I have, and maybe you've heard it, I don't know, but the the demo where Michael sang the whole thing.
No, I haven't heard that.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'll get you one. Okay. It's very interesting to hear, because you know you hear him sing both parts. And yes, Paul famously hated "The Doggone Girl Is Mine." He hated that line, which was not, you know, I agree that's not a work of poetry.
No.
But you know, it was and the song, you know, has gotten mixed reviews. But the fact is, I mean, that was at the time an exciting song, because these were two legends,
yes,
you know, of different generations getting together. That was a big deal,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also I should add, you know, a lot of people don't remember, I think, that that was not the first time they'd worked together, that in fact, Paul had written a song for him for the Off the Wall album called Girlfriend.
Yes.
And of course, Paul ended up recording it himself with Wings. And then Michael still said, well, I still like that. Can I record it for my album? And he did a completely different take on it.
Oh, very different. Yeah.
Very different. And so it's interesting to hear the you know, to compare and contrast the two versions. So, you know, they date back to that. And, you know, I mean, as far as like the news, as you said, that came out this week, I mean, I honestly don't go into that in the book, because let's just say all the legal wranglings, that'd be a whole separate
book. That's a whole book, yeah.
That's a whole book in itself. And mm-hmm. to me, what the whole episode shows is, quite frankly, the raw deal that groups got, and an artist, I should say, got in, you know, the earlier years of rock and roll, where they signed these terrible deals.
Oh, they all got screwed.
They all got screwed. And they don't, you know, today's artists, I think, are much smarter
mm-hmm.
about that. And they end up, you know, they form their own labels, and they, you know, form their own publishing companies so they can own the rights to their songs, which is what you want to do.
Right.
You know, but I mean, when the Beatles signed with Brian Epstein and then negotiated all this stuff, what did they know?
No, they just played rock and roll. They didn't know anything about the legal stuff. Yeah.
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, they just wanted to get on the radio and
be
get
famous.
You know, exactly.
Yeah.
So they didn't know. And, you know, and so a situation like this is just, to me, you know, it's just, you know, a sad reminder of how bad the deals were for earlier artists. And hopefully, I think a lot of artists today have gotten wiser about that. And I think, you know, they are. And, you know, as far as did he have the opportunity to buy I've heard all these different rumors about Paul and Yoko were going to go in mm-hmm. on it together and all this stuff. I don't know, you know, and it's such a complicated story. And I think there are two sides to that story too.
Sure.
Let's put it that way. but, you know, as I said, I don't get into it in the book because it's a whole separate thing, but again, it just shows how deals have changed over time for artists.
Well, I look forward to taking a look at the Michael Jackson book, because I do like a lot of his music, and I'm curious to see how you frame it, because if it's like your Beatles book, it should be equally interesting. So,
oh, thank you.
Look forward to that. And if you are interested in seeing Kit live, you can hear her and see her at two upcoming Beatle-related events, and I wanted to ask you about that as we wrap up here. One is the Grammy Museum Mississippi Conference, the Beatles Conference at Delta State University, which I think is in Cleveland, Mississippi.
Yes,
on April 1st and 2nd, so coming up. And then also at the New York Fest for Beatle Fans on April 15th to the 17th. So what will you be doing at each of those events?
Well, the Grammy Museum, this is a brand new museum. It just opened, I think, March 5th, I think was the opening. And it's in Cleveland, Mississippi. Now you would think right away, why there?
Right.
Well, yep. And, you know, when you research it more, you find out this was the birthplace of the blues. I mean, all of the major artists, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, B.B. King, they all either were born in that area or they played in early juke joints in that area before they came to Chicago and other places. So this is really the Delta Blues, and Robert Johnson came from there. I mean, this is the cradle of the blues. And let's face it, if it weren't for the blues, There'd be no rock.
Nope.
There'd be no R&B.
No Beatles.
There'd be no Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, so it all kind of ties in. It really does. So this is a brand new museum, and this is a Beatles symposium, From the Cavern to Candlestick, it's called. And there's going to be a bunch of authors, me, Bruce Spicer, Jude Kessler, Ivor Davis. Frida Kelly is going to be there.
Great.
We talked about her a minute ago. We're going to do a screening of her film, and then she'll be on hand for a Q&A. It's going to be a great time. I'm going to be doing a presentation that I've done at some other conferences that people seem to really enjoy, called The Top 10 Beatles Sounds That Changed the World.
Ooh.
And yep, and I take a look at 10 sounds, and I isolate them from the songs. You know, it could be a guitar lick and a vocal, or even a backwards loop, you know, that kind of thing. And I talk about how revolutionary these sounds were and how we still hear them in music today. So it's a lot of fun, and it's 2 days, as I said, April 1st and 2nd, at the museum, and it's only $35 for the whole weekend. So
great.
I mean, and you get a concert. I almost forgot about that. There's on Saturday night by a group, the Lonely Peppers, which I've not heard, but I'm sure they're terrific.
With a name like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, so you get all these talks. There are artists that are going to be there. There's an exhibit. I mean, you know, it's going to be a fun weekend. So I hope people can come. The other thing is, yes, the Fest for Beatles fans. It's you know, in New York, April 15th through the 17th. I've never been to the New York conference before, so I'm very excited. And I decided, you know, my first time there, so I've got to go big or go home. So I'm going to do 3 presentations there.
Ooh, wow.
Yep, one of them is a kit and caboodle, as I talked about earlier. We're going to talk about the 50th anniversary of Revolver, and talk about Paul's and John's contributions in particular. I am also doing a presentation with our mutual friend Ken Womack.
Excellent.
We are doing a reconsideration of Beatles for Sale.
I think that album does get slighted a little bit. We didn't get a chance to really talk about it, but I know, to go along with Mr. Moonlight here, I think there are some better tracks on that album than it gets credit for.
So, absolutely. And yeah. I just think it's high time to reconsider that. So so we are going to talk about that, and yes, you get to hear me talk about Mr. Moonlight. If you enjoyed hearing me talk about it here on the show, well, you're going to love it there. But and we will talk about other songs as well, of course. So we're really excited about that. And then the other presentation I'm doing is called Deep Beatles Live. It's the first time I'm doing sort of a live version of my column. I'm going to be talking about 3 underrated songs, but I'm going to have a musician with me, Scott Erickson, who's a terrific guitar player and vocalist. Many of you may know him from, he's played at the Apple Jam stage at these conferences. He's a longtime fixture there. And so I'm going to be introducing the songs, kind of like what I do in my columns, giving some background. He's going to play them for you and talk about them from a musician's standpoint. So
wow, that sounds great too.
Really excited.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. I would love to go. I've also never been to one of the New York conferences. I've been to the conventions, certainly been to Chicago a lot, but I wonder if the vibe is different or what it's like out there. So it'll be interesting to hear your reaction when you get back.
Absolutely. I'm interested too.
Yeah. Well, that's terrific. And where's the best place to find your writings?
Well, you can go to probably the easiest way is you can follow me on Twitter at Kid O'Toole, all one word, lowercase, no apostrophe. And I always post any writing that I do. I write for a few sites, so that'd probably be the easiest way to find out what I'm posting. I'm also on Facebook. You can look for me there, and I have a website. Also imaginatively named kidotool.com. and those are the 3 places that are easiest to find me. And you can also look directly at the sites I write for, Something Else Reviews, Blinded by Sound, and Cinema Sentries. Those are 3 sites I write for, and they have wonderful articles other than mine, obviously. So so take a look at those. But if you just want to follow myself, probably Twitter and Facebook are, and my website are your best bets.
Okay. Well, that's great. So lots of things to check out, and definitely take a look at her two books, Songs We Were Singing, Guided Tours Through the Beatles' Lesser Known Tracks, and Michael Jackson FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the King of Pop. And we're going to go out today. Chris and I will be back with a podcast very soon. Before that, we'll go out by listening to another song that Kit chose here, which is The Word from Rubber Soul, which is something that an album that Chris and I talked about. And I'm curious why you chose The Word and what it means to you.
Well, I think The Word is one of the most important songs they recorded because it's a sign of what was to come. You know, before they recorded this, a lot of their songs, when they were singing love songs, they were romantic love, right? I mean, that was most of the time. Now with The Word, they are changing thematically. You know, this is not about romantic love. This is a freeing force. It's John almost, I mean, it's almost him testifying, you know, saying, let me tell you about what I found out. The word will set you free. It's so fine. It's sunshine. And I mean, it's a preview of what would particularly show up on Sgt. Pepper. I mean, it's amazing when you think about the summer. This was two years before the Summer of Love.
Right.
I know, already. You would think that this song would have been recorded in 1967, and it wasn't. So to me, this is a song, not only is it just a great song anyway, I mean, lyrically, I love the kind of fuzz guitar on there. It's great stuff. Yep, just some great stuff. But I think it's an important milestone in their artistic development that now they're starting to broaden their subject matter. And it's a preview of what was to come in their later recordings.
I love when people offer different perspectives and make me listen to things differently. So I've always liked this tune a lot, and I'm glad you do as well. So we will go out listening to that, and I want to thank Kit for speaking with me today. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you, Dave. I had a great time, and I love this podcast.
Glad to hear that, and go check out her work again, and we will talk to you next time.
It's the word of love. Everywhere I go.